everybody, and warm welcome to the last of our sales lunchtime seminars for the term. It's my great pleasure to welcome our colleague Viola Solanke, who is a senior lecturer at Leeds, and comparatively rare as an empirical researcher in the area of EU law. She has conducted empirical research to do with judges and advocate generals, and she's came to share some of that with us with the talk, the title of which you see on the screen in front of you, Trust and Democracy in the European Judicial Order, the Advocate General, Securing Trust in the CJEU? Over to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming. I know this is the last week of your term, and I'm sure it's been a very hectic semester for you. So thank you for coming, and thank you, of course, to Marcus Gehring, who isn't here, I suspect, for the invitation. So as was said, I'm going to talk about the Advocate General and think about whether the Advocate General can be a way in which that the Court of Justice secures trust in itself. And I'll try to explain why. I'm a bit under the cosh in relation to time, and I've been busy trying to edit my paper, but we'll see how things go. Hopefully I won't edit too much. That's something I tend to do. This paper is part of a larger project, which is the title at the top, looking at trust in democracy in the European judicial order. And as I go through, I'll try to explain what that bigger project is about. But if I just give you quickly an overview of the Advocate General. The Advocate General is a role that was written into the original Treaty of Rome. There were initially two Advocates General, one from France and one from Germany, and their task was to assist the court. Now, I conducted some empirical research in 2006-2007, where I spoke to about 20 Advocates Generals, those who were at the court, those who had been at the court, and I asked them what this meant for them, how they interpreted this idea of their role as assistants to the court. And I thought it would be interesting just to present that, to give you an idea of how they saw their role. Some of them were, a bit perhaps, in some sense, seen themselves as perhaps more helpful to the judges than the judges may have seen the Advocates General. So one said to me, as a doctor helps a sick patient, which implies that the judges themselves are somehow deficient and the Advocates General have to help them by making issues easy to understand or reducing their workload or ensuring that their approach to the issues, the questions arising in a case, is thorough. They also saw themselves as trying to lay out an independent path, as furrowing a route in new ground, which the judges could then use in their decisions. But they also saw their role as performing a function of transparency for the Court of Justice as a whole, and that they added some innovation and dynamism to the jurisprudence of the court. Now, the opinion is the tool that the Advocates Generals produce. And this is a document written prior to the judgment, which the judges discuss in the chamber, along with the report of the juge rapporteur. Now, the judges are under no obligation to follow the suggestions that the Advocate General makes in the opinion. And more to the point, they're under no obligation to explain why they have or haven't followed the suggestions of the Advocate General. The opinion is just that, an opinion. It isn't really an advisory document. It isn't a shadow judgment. As the Advocates Generals themselves told me, it's just an opinion, a place for new suggestions, perhaps a different layer of analysis, the first word in a conversation, the beginning of a decision, even if it is rejected. Now, if we want to think about the role of the Advocate General in a larger context, it's a bit difficult because there is no analogy in any of the member states to what the Advocate General does in the Court of Justice. One analogy I did find was perhaps in a paper written by an American academic who said of a trial judge in America, that a trial judge is in a privileged position because, in a way, she knows that if they can't convince the court, that their opinion will be ignored or overruled, thus preventing damage to the courts, and thereby the Advocate General, similarly to the trial judge in America, it enjoys a position where they can experiment with the law, where they can try to develop and be a bit entrepreneurial, because they know that their ideas will not damage the law as such. Now, it was really only with the study by Burroughs and Greaves in 2007 that the Advocate General started to be studied in their own right. Until fairly recently, the Court of Justice has been studied as a monolithic institution. And if you think about its size in 1957, that makes sense. There were only seven judges and two Advocates General. Now, however, there are three courts, 61 judges and eight Advocates General. Now, whilst the task of the Advocates General remains the same, to assist the court by writing these opinions, the Lisbon Treaty has actually given the Court of Justice a new duty. So in Article 13, the Lisbon Treaty says that the Union shall have an institutional framework which shall aim to promote its values, advance its objectives, serve its interests and those of its citizens and those of the member states, etc. The Court of Justice is listed in that article as one of the institutions upon whom this duty applies, upon whom this duty is imposed. So what I want to consider in this next stage of my project, looking at trust and democracy, is what this duty actually means for the court itself and what it implies for the role of the Advocate General. So what I want to do in the next 20 minutes now, probably, is to think about this by considering, firstly, the objective of this duty. Secondly, think about the judicial and social and political context within which this duty has appeared in the Lisbon Treaty. Then I want to think about what I call the institutional posture of the Court of Justice currently and what that means in relation to this new duty. Then I want to present the results of some more recent empirical work trying to identify the impact of separate opinions on judicial authority. And then I want to think about, finally, whether the Advocate General can play a role in helping the Court of Justice to fulfill this new duty to serve the interests of its citizens. And if I have the time, I'll end by suggesting that the Advocate General can help the court in fulfilling this duty if the Advocate General were able to write concurrent opinions. Right then, to the objective of Article 13. What could the member states hope to achieve by introducing this? Well, one suggestion is that the member states are actually trying to encourage us to the member states are trying to develop a relationship of trust with the citizens. They want us to think of the institutions as our institutions, and they want the institutions to think of European Union citizens as their citizens. So they're trying, in the absence of more overt constitutional mechanisms, such as the flag and the anthem, which, as we all know, were ruled out when the Constitution when the constitutional treaty was rejected. This clause is meant to operate like a fidelity clause. The European leaders want us to feel some kind of loyalty towards the institutions, and in order to get that, it must convince us to trust it. And in order to trust it, we must have the confidence that the institutions are serving our interests. What do I mean by trust? Well, I think in brief, trust can be described as the confidence that authorities won't exploit the power that has been vested in them, and that they will more often than not behave in a way that is beneficial to us, or at least not detrimental to us. So trust implies that the institutions will behave in a way that serves our interests. And I think such trust in legal institutions in particular is very important because it's the foundation of our confidence in judicial decision making. Now, if we look at some surveys conducted in the commercial sector, we do see some indication that trust actually has a value. There's something called the Edelman Trust Barometer, which conducts surveys on the impact of trust. And this barometer has concluded that when we trust an organization, we are much less likely to believe negative information about it. Whereas if we do not trust the information, the first time we hear negative information about that organization, we will believe it. Therefore, trust has real value. And given the, especially in this country, given the public opinion about the European Union, trust is quite crucial, I think, for the institutions to develop. Why is this important now? Well, I think a number of reasons. If we think firstly about the judicial context, courts are changing. They're changing due to technology. For example, the Supreme Court now tweets, and the Supreme Court proceedings are now televised. And at the same time, courts are actually having more of an influence in our everyday life, primarily due to the expansion in the recognition of human rights. But in addition to that, the role of courts is increasing because there are simply more laws. There are much more areas that fall under the scope of judicial authority. And it's argued in some sectors that law has displaced politics as the language of power. Given the discrediting of politics and the discrediting of the clergy, legal language and law has replaced the politics and religion as a normalizing force. So we look to judges more for leadership and for guidance and for moral authority. At the same time, judges are more visible. The media also writes a lot more now about the judiciary. At the same time, judges are now expected to pay more attention to social context. They're encouraged to think about the implications of their rulings. Now, because of that, and because judges are also more visible, we expect a different attitude or different standards from the judiciary. We expect them to now perform more in a similar vein to our traditional institutions. We expect them to look more like our other democratic institutions. So we expect from them things like efficiency. We expect more from them in terms of transparency and increasingly in terms of accountability. So recently there have been a number of books written which use the phrase judicial accountability. 10 or 20 years ago, that would have been an oxymoron. Now it seems to make sense to us. We may not know what it means in detail, but the idea itself is no longer as contradictory as it may have been some years ago. Now, going back to Article 13, as the Court of Justice, like all courts, does become more visible, and absolute deference to the judiciary in general declines, it's more important to build these relationships of trust. They can no longer be taken for granted. Developing means to this end may ultimately prove beneficial, I think, because in the long term, respect for the judiciary can only be enhanced if public opinion is able to see that judges do not live in an ivory tower, that they are citizens like everybody else, and they live in the real world just like the rest of us. But in particular, the stronger participatory democracy envisioned in the Lisbon Treaty arguably requires heightened trust in the judiciary, if for no other reason than to keep the EU as a whole trustworthy. Now, sadly, little has been done over the years to develop trust between the court and its peoples. If we think in particular about the application of Article 263, Paragraph 4, then we can see that individuals have little reason to feel that the Court of Justice is their court. So how can this trust be created? Well, if we think about the way in which the court operates, apart from Article 263, paragraph 4, transparency has not been a key element in the way in which the court speaks to its peoples. It has been univocal and unanimous. It has only ever produced one line of reasoning in its judgments and one decision. This has been criticized by academics here at Cambridge, Bob Heppel, Catherine Bernard, who have spoken very strongly about the strong stench of compromise pervading the decision-making of the court. And also Lord Mance of the Supreme Court has called the Court of Justice obscure, and or rather called the jurisprudence of the court obscure and rigid, and sometimes incoherent. Now, this type of decision-making from the court, whereby one decision is given, is common to courts that are assume a posture of corporatism. The idea of a corporate court is one where the decision given represents the voice of the court, and the judge within that court is simply a messenger delivering the wisdom of that court. The judges serve the institution, and they have no individual voice of themselves. And any judge that does dare to try to raise their own voice is looked at, is frowned upon, as we see the bad egg in the middle there. Individual voices in the corporate model of a court are seen as damaging to the authority of the court because they undermine the coherence and the clarity of the body, and also reduce the aura of collegiality and independence. Now, many people are surprised to know that the United States Supreme Court was, in its earliest formation, a corporatist court. It has come a very long way to the voice, the court of multiple voices that we know today. The reason why the U.S. Supreme Court was corporatist in its early days was because, according to Justices Marshall and Taft, it needed to take a firm stance and present itself as an authoritative body in order to build its legitimacy. Now, that is an argument that is used in the Court of Justice today to argue against the incorporation of separate opinions, i.e. to argue for the continued deliverance of a single decision. It's argued that the Court of Justice also hasn't yet matured to the stage where its voice would continue to be seen as legitimate and authoritative if there were dissenting opinions. Now, there is value in a single voice. There is definitely some a reason to do that sometimes. If we think about the decision of Brown versus Board of Education in the United States, the one of the key desegregation cases, the justices then were very keen to find unanimity and produce a single judgment in order to show the country that the Supreme Court agreed on this very important issue, but also in order to reduce the opportunity for disobedience by the states themselves. So there is some value in a single judgment. But that main argument that separate opinions somehow undermine the authority of a court hasn't really been proven empirically. So my recent project is to try to elucidate the impact of separate opinions on judicial authority and to question whether it does actually undermine or enhance trust in a court. I'll skip through that. So my questionnaire is quite short. It just has 10 questions, and then I use 3 short scenarios and 5 questions associated with that. And I'm going to present here just 3 questions. So question 3 to which you see the responses here, and also my my sample is quite small at the moment, only 34. So I asked participants, judges, academics, practitioners, and members of civil society, whether they had more trust in a court that agreed in public and disagreed in private, or agreed in public and disagreed in public. While amongst the academics, the majority said that they would have more trust in a court that agreed in public and disagreed in public, and the same for the judges. They also said that they would have more trust if a court were able to display its disagreements in public, because that demonstrated not only some courage, but also showed the public that there was deliberation in the court, but also, equally importantly, I think, through that deliberation, it could be the case that judges could shift their positions. So the deliberation itself enhanced the quality of the final decision. Now, another question I asked was whether separate opinions were useful in an increasingly complex society, and then whether they were necessary in an increasingly complex society. The judges, most judges and academics and all of the practitioners agreed that separate opinions were useful. Most in all of those groups, however, disagreed that separate opinions were necessary. So separate opinions are seen as a tool that can help in a complex society, but not as something that needs to be done. They shouldn't be, separate opinions shouldn't be mandatory, but they can be useful. Now, moving on from that, I thought, well, what could be then some other appropriate fora for active judges to express themselves? And here I had some quite interesting responses. So I asked whether, for example, active judges could express their opinion in an autobiography or a newspaper article or a blog or a television show or a radio interview. While amongst all of my different groups there, the answers were overwhelmingly negative. These public platforms are not seen as appropriate ways for judges to express their opinions on the case. And I asked specifically about active judges, so judges who are serving and making decisions. There was a bit more ambiguity when it came to things like the separate opinion and then also the interaction between the judiciary and academia. So, for example, academics were interestingly quite ambiguous when it came to the expression using academic journal articles and public lectures for the expression of judicial opinions. Some agreed, some disagreed, and an interesting number were unsure, whereas academics were very clear, separate opinions are where we apparently want to see the opinions of judges expressed. Judges themselves were interestingly ambiguous when it came to the separate opinion. They weren't sure. They thought it was useful, but sometimes it could be used to excess. And it should only really be used if the judge felt that there was a burning point to be made that had been missed by the majority. Again, with the academic journal article, there were some different opinions there. Interestingly, the public lecture didn't find much support amongst the judges. Only two out of the cohort said definitely that was a platform that judges should use. Practitioners and civil society were split evenly amongst the options. In terms of where then there was agreement as to where judges should express their opinion, obviously the court decision. An intra-court conversation, judges were more likely to use that forum, whereas some academics felt that wouldn't be an appropriate forum, and some practitioners also were unsure whether that would be an appropriate forum. The academic survey, academics of course, said, yes, we think it's good for judges to talk to us. Judges themselves were a bit equivocal, they weren't so sure. And some of them, an interesting number, said, actually, no, we don't think that we should be expressing our opinions to academics. We should be expressing our opinions to our colleagues in the court or in the judgment itself. And if it can't go into the judgment, then we just have to keep it to ourselves or save it for literature after we've left the bench. So I need to do more interviews. I need to speak to more practitioners and more members of civil society, but I also want to speak to some more students, because I think if they're going to be future judges, it would be interesting to discover how they see separate opinions. So my interim conclusions are that for the most part, academics and judges see the separate opinion as a channel to enhance transparency. And there isn't actually an alternative for judges to do this. And in fact, as we see from this question, use of a more populist medium would actually undermine levels of trust in a court. So, moving on, what would the court look like, or what could the Court of Justice look like if it were to allow separate opinions? A model that we can look at is the European Court of Human Rights, which does, of course, allow for majority decision-making. Drawing upon research created by White and Busiaku, they found that there were this many different types of voices used at the European Court of Human Rights. In addition to the unanimous judgment, there was a majority judgment with a dissenting opinion by a single judge, a concurrent opinion by a single judge, a partly dissenting opinion by a single judge, a partly dissenting and partly concurrent opinion by a single judge, etc., etc. It can get a bit complicated and it can get a bit messy when there are too many voices, independent voices, expressed at a court. But the important thing is that when a court does use majority decision-making and separate opinions, it adopts a different institutional posture, and it then becomes a more deliberative court. And such a court is seen as one that has a less distant institutional position from the persons who are affected by its decision. The court sees itself as integral to democratic governance and sees its role as providing an authoritative forum for independent debate. Judges in such a deliberative court are seen as individuals and are encouraged to express their individual opinions. They're seen as legal democrats, arguing and responding and engaging with one another with respect to their legal disagreements. And dissent in a more deliberative court is seen to be a healthy and even necessary practice that can improve the way in which law is made. Now, Article 13, which I showed you earlier, does suggest that the European Union leaders want a more deliberative court in the European Union. But the Court of Justice, as I expressed, perhaps for some good reason, is less convinced that the time is right for this. So it may be a question that we have to think about as something that the court can do in the future once the Court of Justice feels that it has established its authority within the European Union. So in the meantime, what can be done? Until the Court of Justice is comfortable with the idea and the use of majority and separate opinions, how can transparency be introduced to engender trust? And what can the Advocate General do to contribute to this? Well, the Advocate General, as I said earlier, is the only visible member of the court because the Advocate General will sign their opinion. So their voice is seen as independent and objective, but most importantly, a voice that is internal to the Court of Justice. So the opinion is addressed to the judges from a situation within the court itself. So you could think of the Advocate General role as providing a critical voice within the Court of Justice. But the Advocate General opinion is not a separate opinion. And I also asked them about this when I asked them about what they thought their opinion on separate opinions. So in the current context of a corporatist court, there are ways, perhaps, in which we can see into what the judges think. And one way that was suggested to me when I did an interview there a few weeks ago was to look at the silences of the court. So in a corporatist court, dissent, or rather criticism, is as frowned upon as dissent. The court cannot express, cannot give any expression which undermines the idea of collegiality. So at the moment, if we want to see behind the lines or behind the judgments, what we can look at is where the court is absolutely silent on what the Advocate General says. And one example, one recent example that comes to mind is the Zambrano case. Did the court agree with Advocate General Sharpstone in her reformulation of the meaning of Article 20 to separate the idea of movement and residence, or did it not? We don't know because the court didn't say anything. But the suggestion is that we can tell because the court didn't say anything. So the silence of the court is our transparency. The court was silent because it disagreed. It requires a lot of work to read into the silences of the court. So whilst that might be one way of transparency, it perhaps isn't the easiest. Perhaps the court is expecting a bit too much from us in that respect. So one alternative suggestion I have is for the court to allow the Advocate General to write concurring opinions. Now, I realise there are all kinds of problems with this. The Advocate General isn't part of the deliberate, so wouldn't be within the chamber to actually know what the judges are discussing. But in response to that argument, I would say, well, the Advocate General will know more than the rest of us. At least the Advocate General is there in the court and is part of that institution and can add more and can elucidate more the thinking of the court than the rest of us who are in our respective member states. The other obvious problem with that is that there are only 8 Advocates General and they already have a lot to do. But that was one idea that I came across thinking about this paper. I think that there does have to be some thought given to transparency, especially if we are to take the new duty of the court in Article 13 seriously. Transparency is a prerequisite of trust, and in the context of the new judicial and social and political expectations of society, there does need to be, I think, a way in which the Court of Justice responds to that in order to serve the interests of its citizens. Thank you for your attention.